Welcome to the all-new VM Podcast. This is where we discuss the latest and most fascinating, powerful, and disruptive additive manufacturing and 3D printing technologies with the people that invent, develop, use, and market them. Join us on this journey as we take you from voxels to matter through the most advanced applications across aerospace, automotive, healthcare, consumer products, and the most advanced areas of digital production. I am your host, Davide Scher, CEO and co-founder of Voxel Matters, the most trusted media, marketing, and market research firm for the ever-growing world of additive manufacturing. Get ready for an electrifying start of the new season of the Voxel Matters podcast. In 2024, we are diving headfirst into the boundless world of additive manufacturing, exploring an array of applications spanning industries, materials, and parts. To kick off this journey, we've got an extraordinary story to share with you. Brace yourselves for a game-changing narrative about a company that's not just redesigning parts for AM, but reimagining them through code. Meet Leap 71. The pioneers of a revolutionary computational engineering approach to part design. They aren't just transforming the way we create some of the world's most cutting-edge products, they're also shaping the future of 3D printing, making it an indispensable cornerstone of tomorrow's manufacturing. Leap 71 has wowed us with their mind-boggling creations, working with industry giants like AMCM and the Fraunhofer Institute. While we've heard about parametric and generational design for at least a decade, Leap 71 is taking a quantum leap beyond existing 3D design software. In this episode, we sit down with the masterminds behind Leap 71, who also happen to constitute the company's entire workforce, Josephine Listner and Lynn Kaiser. Together, we unravel how they're harnessing software algorithms to craft the new era of exceptionally complex physical products. What's more, they're open sourcing their knowledge and their disruptive peacock geometry kernel with the world. Josephine, Lynn, it's a pleasure to have you here. Let's dive in. How are computational engineering and 3D printing ushering in the next cycle of advanced manufacturing?
Question is, what does that actually mean? You know,
right.
How do you take advantage of these new capabilities? And I got fascinated with 3D printing about 10 years ago, a bit more now, 12 years almost. And I asked myself, how can you take full advantage of this new paradigm? And I said to myself, probably needs some way of creating algorithms to design things, because even simple algorithms can create very complex objects, and 3D printers basically the best way to produce them. And as you may know, I started a company called Hyperganic to take advantage of that. A few years ago, Josephine joined Hyperganic, and we said, let's build something that really blows everybody's minds. And
good.
We decided this aerospike rocket engine.
Yeah, that was my master thesis back then. And that was my first coding project. So while I was doing that, I was learning how to code.
Yeah.
Because when you are educated as an engineer, which I was, so I'm a traditional aerospace engineer, you don't really know, you don't learn how to code these days, which is ridiculous when you think of it. It's the 21st century and everything is software driven, yet engineers don't learn how to code. How ridiculous. And that was true for me as well.
Yeah.
So I learned that as my first experience at Hyperganic.
Yeah, and we decided to build this crazy thing.
The original one was printed with AMCM.
Yeah.
From copper. But when I sent them the design, they didn't want to print it because they said they need 20 attempts. It will cost like an endless amount of money.
Of course.
And we forced them into printing it. You sometimes have to force people to their luck. Right?
I had to call and say, Hans, this is really important.
Just print it. And then it worked the first go. And then they were like, oh, wow, this is the most complex part we ever printed. And we were sure that it's going to fail somewhere. And then I said, okay, but I tried to frame all of these rules that define whether it's printable or not in my algorithms, which means that this code that runs to generate the aerospike, it will not produce anything that is not printable if I have taken care of all the rules, which I tried to.
Sure.
And the fact that it printed first go was the proof to the process.
So this was the hypergenic time, but we said, what are we actually trying to do? We are trying to change how engineers work. And so we started a new company, Leap 71, last year. And we said, the geometry kernel, that's actually not the interesting thing. What is interesting is what you build on top. And I wrote a new geometry kernel. We open sourced it last year. So we said, everybody can just use it. It's there to stay. And we are basing new things on top of that, which create interesting objects. And we work with many different fields. We have some, I mean, we're both space buffs, so we do a lot of work in aerospace. I don't know if you saw the announcement we did last year with the Exploration Company. So Exploration Company is one of the fastest growing space companies in Europe. They just signed a deal with Axiom Space to supply their commercial space stations with cargo. Rocket engines are now based on Josephine's computational models for space propulsion.
Our technology stack has two layers, basically. So the foundational layer is the geometry kernel, which Lynn wrote last year, and which is Peacock. So that's what I use to generate the geometry and the file that I can print. And on top of this, we have computational engineering models. They use Peacock, so they sit on top, and we have different ones. So we have some for rocket engines, we have some for heat exchangers, electric motors, biotissues, moving parts and mechanism, different stuff. We focus mainly on applications that we are personally interested in. So our philosophy is, because we're a small company, we do the stuff we enjoy. And if there are any things that are useful but are not our primary target, we will open source them. So there's a very strong commitment to open source.
I think maybe it's better not to be a really big company at this time. And also, I guess you don't think metal 3D printing is dead, and you do think that your business will be in demand in the future.
So first of all, I think you're completely right. I think a lot of the companies out there scaled beyond the market size, current market size. Everybody thinks that additive manufacturing is an island on its own. And I think that's the fundamental mistake people are making. It needs to be a part of a larger manufacturing chain. And I think this is what drives me nuts about additive right now, that they are fighting amongst each other for market share, forgetting they're currently fighting about a tiny slice of the manufacturing market instead of asking themselves, how can I fit into this larger manufacturing market? But the other problem is, of course, nobody knows how to take advantage of
it. It's a big issue too,
So if you try to print things that you can also produce with casting or with milling or whatever, this is not really useful.
But also there was a lot of hype, and especially the main players, they scaled according to hype, basically. So now they've also fall victim to that. And the reason why we are a small company is because we want to be independent of all this hype and up and down, and be focused on the actual work, knowing that there are fluctuations all the time, but we don't want to fall victim to that and do stupid and unreasonable stuff just because the market says something is in or out.
Having said that's also easier to be a software company, and it's very hard to focus a larger company, not even to speak about much larger companies like EOS or whatever, on a single goal. One interesting thing that you see in the realm of software is that even super impactful companies, for example, in generative AI, have a dozen employees or so.
You don't actually need that many people. You just need the right people. We are so efficient, like you can't beat that. If we were to hire a third person, we would all drop in efficiency.
And the other thing I think that the two of us really realized is that we only want to work on stuff that is of high interest to us. We want to move this industry forward. We want to have an impact. That's one of the reasons why we said, let's open source, as Josephine said, let's open source a lot of things that maybe other people would attach a lot of value to. You just open sourced a quite substantial heat exchanger, where we're like, nah, this is not what we want to do. Let other people use this and actually have an impact on the industry. And if it's because we open source this thing, wonderful, we can be proud of that. But we don't want to hire 5 people who work on heat exchangers that don't interest us. We'd rather focus on things that are of real interest to us.
Yep.
So getting back to what you were saying, it was 10 years ago, I guess, they started talking about the idea of parametric and generative design. So how is what you're doing different from that?
I think the fundamental point that we want to make is, first of all, you know, all of these systems, they have invested in their specific way of doing things with their geometry. So Bradley, he was the first person who really said, let's use implicit geometry to describe things. Onshape has the existing CAD kernel and bought a lot of new parts to it, but fundamentally it's a classic CAD system.
So yeah, there are different ways of representing geometry to start very basic. And depending on which geometry representation you choose, some geometric operations are easier, some are harder. So it's okay, which battle do you pick? And traditionally CAD kernels are surface-based, because if you think back of subtractive manufacturing, milling, what you're interested in is where is the surface. So all your boxes and simple shapes are represented through the surface. 3D printing started to challenge that, because there it's more about the volume, because you're building up the volume step by step and the surfaces become very complex. So complex 3D printed objects typically challenge traditional CAD representations.
Yeah.
And NTOP were the first to say, hey, there's a different way of doing that, which is implicits, which is through mathematical formulas, which very nice for certain applications like gyroids. It's just one mathematical formula and you can repeat it to the end of the world and it's very elegant. And it also has some drawbacks for other stuff that you might want to do.
Yeah, because now you have to describe everything
through a
formula, and some things are really hard to describe.
Gotcha.
The formula. And that, I think, is why you see NTOP being used for lots of infills and stuff like that, but not really to create new things. Yeah, it's always you take an existing thing and then you fill it with something and you lightweight it. So the idea that I postulated almost 10 years ago is every object has a resolution. It's made out of particles. If you go really deep, it's atoms and molecules, right? But a 3D printer, of course, has a much lower resolution. It has like little particles that it's made of.
The box, so the voxel, I guess that would be the voxel.
Yeah,
the voxel. And so I said to my co-founder of Hypergamic back then, Michael, I said, Michael, why don't we represent the world as basically three-dimensional images, so to speak? And this simplifies a lot of things, because you can always go down to this model. You can say either this voxel is there or it's not there. There's nothing to be concerned about. You can use the way NTOP is doing it by modulating space, and then you render it into a voxel field. You can use a surface description and you render it into a voxel field. And you always have these voxels as single source of truth. And there's nothing complicated about voxels. It's just a lot of little cubes in space, so to speak. Yeah.
It's like Minecraft. Yeah.
Okay, sure. I understand that.
The benefit is that your mathematical representation becomes damn stupid. Like it's on or off, basically, which means that it's very robust. There cannot be a intersection and a floating point, overflow, instability, whatever. It's either on or off. It's
CAD is really unstable. CAD is really unstable. Anybody who's used the CAD system knows that sometimes you try to do something and then it just doesn't work. And you're like, what the heck?
Why?
It worked 5 minutes ago and changed a few things and now it doesn't work. Now you have to move stuff around and fiddle around until it works. And this is a fundamental problem. It's not because the CAD system has a bug. It's because of the way geometry is represented. It's just very complex with all these shapes and space.
And now if we think of that, we want to automate geometry generation, it's really bad if you have a kernel that randomly breaks, because then you need a human sitting in front of the screen and saying, oh, I just pull it slightly and then it works again.
Yeah.
So this voxel representation is very robust, and that's one key ingredient for an automated workflow. Because if you have an algorithm and you want to generate hundreds of objects, and it fails after the second one, then yeah, you need one guy to go in and work manually on the thing, so you have not really won anything.
This is a lot of technical explanation, but if you want to have the fundamental difference between our approach and what everybody else is doing, everybody else is creating a tool for a human to design one object.
Visually.
And what we are doing is, what we are saying is, let's distill the knowledge of an engineer into computer algorithms and have these computer algorithms be able to generate an entire class of objects. So we're not creating one rocket engine, we have a rocket engine generator. We don't generate one heat exchanger, we have a heat exchanger generator. And of course, a lot of these algorithms, they start to cross-pollinate other solutions. So if you have one component that routes cooling channels across, I don't know, a rocket engine, it can be used to route the same cooling channels across a heat exchanger or around an electric motor or whatever, right? So it's more software than a visual tool to design one thing.
So when you picture me working, I code 90% of the time. So I write code and then I click the button and it executes the program and I will see the visual output, but I don't interact with it at all. I just look at it. That's all I do. So it's a very different way of interaction. I don't click and drag stuff around. I look at it. If I see, oh, it's wrong, I go into my algorithm, I change the lines of code, I run it again, I check, and so on. So it's very much distilling this knowledge and writing computer modules that I can then link together and build an object.
And you never repeat the same task, right? You write an algorithm and then you execute this algorithm. And unless the algorithm doesn't work the way you intend it to be, you will never touch it again. It will just work. So you're going from, I design a complicated object visually on screen by repetitive clicks, to, okay, let's route the cooling channels automatically. Let's connect the flange to inlet and outlet. It's more abstract.
Yeah, you're so calling software.
I have three questions. So one is, you can combine more algorithms together.
That's a huge scaling potential. And we start to see that because when I started, there was no code base, so I had to do everything from scratch. But after weeks and months, you actually see how this code knowledge grows.
Okay.
And because it's completely abstract, I start to combine all of these. So today, I think 60%, 70%, I just use code modules that I've written in the past, and I might combine them in a new way to achieve a new object. And then in 40%, 30%, I will write something new because I don't have it in my library yet, but it will be in my library afterwards. So it grows every day.
Yeah.
So, and this is the main value creation that we have at Leap71. We are building these engineering models that have knowledge in them and that you can recycle endlessly, basically, and improve over time.
So your client is a person that comes to you to use your software to produce what they need, or an engineer that has to learn how to code, or how do you use your software today and how will you use it in the future?
To be clear, all of our software, all of our customers code. So what we do is we do a joint project with a customer based on our open source technology, and we implement something for the customer and say, okay, you want to create, I don't know, a combustion chamber for a rocket engine. Either they can just go ahead and do it themselves because
then they're not our customers.
So they usually don't know how to do it.
And usually they have some task in mind that they failed on another software.
Yeah, they, so can't, they say, can't do it.
Yeah, I want this cooling with a triangular shape and no software can do it. Can you do it?
Yeah, or we want to create a heat exchanger for a specific application or a combustion chamber for a rocket engine or whatever.
Yeah.
And we don't know how to do it. Can you do it for us? But then comes the interesting thing. Now you could say, yeah, okay, we're just a service provider. We give them a combustion chamber. No, we give them the code that produces the combustion chamber. And now we teach them how to use that code and to extend the code to build on top of that.
Yeah.
And that's it for us. So we're not trying to bind that customer to us and say, okay, now you have to use our services whenever you want to have a different screw hole somewhere. No, we move it over and we move on to the next project. And this is also because we think this is a paradigm shift. And this paradigm shift can only happen if we teach people how to actually utilize this new paradigm. It would be very easy for us to say, oh, they have to come to us and we have this magic software that we're not telling anybody about. Mm-hmm. No, this is not what we want. This is one of the reasons why we open source it. We say people should utilize this to change how engineering works in general. And yeah, we're happy to make money getting you started, but we're also not that interested in the last 2% of where you need a lot of iterations and it gets really boring.
Yeah, sure. So that's the thing. Initially, you have to write the code, which is like the mentally challenging thing. But then once you get into testing, printing, iterating, you're actually just changing parameters. So you say, instead of 1.3, I want 1.4 and then regenerate. Or you have secret input parameters that you don't want to tell us, then the customer can do it himself.
And people make a lot of money providing these kinds of services. But this is really not how we want to spend our lives, right? So we want to work on mentally challenging, interesting things that have never been done before. And so this is our modus operandi. So we are a service provider who hands over the secret sauce to the customer,
sure,
and then we move on to everybody else.
And you mentioned before you leap from one algorithm to another or something like that. Is that what the name comes from?
We moved to Dubai, and the United Arab Emirates were started in 1971. And one of the reasons why we moved here is just because there's an incredible dynamic here. It's an incredibly forward-looking country, and it's small, right? It's 10 million people, 9 of which are expats. And everybody's here trying to move forward fast. It's maybe how the Silicon Valley was like 50 years ago.
Sure.
You know, it's very few people, very few places in the world where you see this. And they have this really ambitious mission for they want to be after 100 years of the Emirates, which is in 2071. And we say, okay, let's leap forward. Let's leap forward to that vision, you know, by implementing.
Okay.
Let us be part of this. And that's why it's called Leap 71. It's incredibly international and tolerant. I think this is the thing that most people find surprising. It's incredibly tolerant. People from all walks of life, people behaving in all kinds of different ways, people dressed in anything from almost nothing to completely in black. So it's everything.
Everything,
right?
Yeah, of course. No, that's great. I'm guessing to a certain extent in a different way.
We do work a lot with Germany and Europe because the technology is really good. It's really good. What is missing is this dynamic, this, oh, let's do something great. In Europe, we always try to build a tool and then we try to offer this tool to somebody and hope that somebody uses this tool to build something. So we have to say, let's build this. Okay, what do we need in order to build this? What kind of printing technology do we need? So we have a goal in mind and then put everything in place to actually achieve that goal. So this is a little bit more the United States approach.
Sure.
You're like, okay, we want to occupy Mars.
what
do I need?
Right.
Oh, we need the world's biggest rocket. Okay, let's build one. You know, in Germany, in Europe, you know, we always try to say, okay, let's build the most amazing drill, and then hopefully somebody wants to drill holes. You know, if nobody wants to drill holes, then we are screwed.
So screwed. Nice.
That's a nice analogy. But what we say at Leap is, okay, let's build the most advanced rocket engines out there, and let's actually go ahead and build a computational model for it. And then all of a sudden somebody comes, like the exploration company, and said, oh, we heard you have an amazing computational model for rocket engines. We actually want to build rocket engines. Okay, let's work together. Yeah, and that's a novel way of doing things. And it comes from the goal. Okay, what do you need to build a space-faring economy? What do you need? So everybody's talking about climate change. What do you need to cool the world? How do you make air conditioning more efficient? Let's look at these things. Let's go from the goal.
Yeah, and you will see that in the way that we present Leap 71. And for example, in our Instagram feed, we only show the complete finished object. We don't show the user interface or the code or whatever, like most software companies do. We show the actual object as the thing that we want to build using our methods.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite it's, I think, relatively obvious that we can build very complex objects and that we differentiate ourselves through that to other companies who say, we have a nice tool where you can do an infill, and here you can do a bit of routing, and here you can do a... They have lots of scattered little bits that you can do with the software, and this is how they show it, while we show you the entire object, which of course has all of these features, but it's the whole thing.
And we want to inspire people. So we're saying, have you ever seen something like that? Haven't. Maybe it's something you should be interested in. Maybe you can go to our GitHub and learn how to do this yourself. And by the way, we have source code that shows you how to design an advanced heat exchanger. Learn it, because this is the future.
Yeah.
So if we are more motivated by creating a movement towards computational engineering than trying to sell you one software or other or whatever.
We actually have a lot of young engineers. They look at our objects and they say, oh, wow, this is how I thought the future looks. I want to design something like this. What do I need to do in order to be able to design this? And then we say, hey, you need to learn coding. But it's not we say you have to learn coding. So it's the desire to build objects like that motivates people to learn the methodology. That's the perspective that we come from.
So we do build desire on the people who may want to learn, and we build desire on the people who think, oh, wow, this is a really cool way to build rocket engines. Maybe I should be doing this myself. And this is how we make money, right?
Having said that, there is a clear distinction between the group of engineers who actually want to learn new stuff like coding, and there's a large portion of engineers who actually just want to click buttons. So we target the first group, obviously.
Sure. But beyond the space parts, where do you think there could be applications? Have you identified other applications? Like, I'm thinking, of course, in the automotive segment. The other question was, which projects are you actually involved in now and that you can talk about?
Let's talk abstractly first. Under the assumption that engineering is a logical process, our methodology lends itself to everything that is logical because it's computer code. Where it's much harder is if someone says, oh, just make it look nice.
Okay, sure.
Because I don't work with the visual result. I work with the rules that I need to follow in order to achieve it. So everything that has a clear methodology of you have to do step 1, 2, 3 and so on, and you have some physical equations or some data that you can base that algorithm on, that's a perfect application. If it's like a black magic field where you say, oh, it needs to look nice and I want it slightly different, but I cannot tell you how exactly, that's too abstract. It's very hard for me to work. That's where you want to drag on the screen and say, I want to change it slightly here.
Yeah, so as Josephine said, this basically encompasses all of engineering. We think that in a few years from now, people will only work this way because, frankly, it makes no sense to work in a different way. And by the way, this is, speaking of 3D printing, this is when 3D printing will make it all of a sudden a overnight success. Oh my God, nobody saw that coming. We've seen that a million times. AI. We watched an AI documentary and they showed self-driving cars in the 1950s.
Yeah, and they had 2 hype cycles since.
Yeah,
and
so,
we just have.
And it always comes out of the blue. This,
yeah,
if you
of
want
course.
To know if 3D will make a comeback, it's when there's a sufficient amount of computational engineering. Concretely, electromechanical actuators is a very interesting field, especially because of these new multi-material 3D printers like the Fraunhofer one. Leap71 has computational models for these systems. And the interesting thing is when you 3D print an electric motor, you can come up with completely new geometry. Why is an electric motor cylindrical?
You have to assemble it, that's the answer.
Because Werner von Siemens wound a copper wire when he built an electric motor. That's how we do it. So lots of really interesting things. And this concretely. So I think on mobility on Earth, on the ground, it's probably a bit further off than with air mobility, because air mobility has a lot of requirements that cannot be fulfilled by today's electric motors. And so we think that this is probably a very interesting field. And the other field that is very interesting is robotics, because robots currently, they're completely over-engineered because you have to pick electric motors that are always oversized for what you want, because the size you want is never there. And that has huge implications on the engineering of the thing. But if you had custom built electric motors for robotics, it would change a lot of the...
Anything multi-material is very interesting for us, because of course we can describe three-dimensional material distributions.
Voxels again, this material, right. Material.
Yeah. One thing that we're just about getting started is mechanisms and motion.
Yeah.
So Peacock is, I think, the first kind of generative design tool where you can actually move the parts around and you can use the motion of an object to design the object and the shape.
Yeah.
So
we haven't shown this really, but we have entire gear trains and stuff all moving, all interlocking.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff will come in
so
this field.
Wow. The logic that we're encapsulating is not only describing the shape, but also describing the motion of an object.
Yeah.
I think I've seen that you design things to be printed not just by powder bed fusion, but also by DED.
Anything. Yeah.
Wire arc or whatever. You know, so.
Yeah.
Even low resolution things.
Well, depending on the print process, there will be a few things that I choose. It's the voxel size, so how fine, how coarse is it? The overhang angles, wall thicknesses, stuff like that, and this will be respected in the algorithm.
Right.
So I have a rocket engine where I say, okay, this is for SLM, but then if I change it to wire arc and will run it again, it will look different because it propagates through all the wall thicknesses, all the details will look different.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's not just 3D printing, because I think the biggest fallacy that we both see in the market right now is that 3D printing is a boutique island and it should be integrated with other processes. So we have several projects ongoing where we integrate several processes, for example, milling in addition to 3D printing. So the computational model doesn't necessarily have to produce a 3D model that then is processed by somebody else. It can directly drive the manufacturing process. So it can directly output slices. It can directly output CNC paths. It can directly output robotics code that moves stuff around. You know?
Sure, so, okay.
Yeah, because CAD is a visual process, everybody assumes that an engineer produces a blueprint. And that blueprint then, on the construction side, somebody looks at the blueprint and says, okay, we're going to build this in that way. But if you have a computational model, you can directly drive simulation. You can directly drive a manufacturing process. You could theoretically directly drive an entire manufacturing.
Because all the knowledge is written down in the algorithm already. I don't need anyone to re-engineer that afterwards.
Yeah.
So if you think of that in the future, the geometry, the shape that we output is just for the human to look at. The machine doesn't need it. The machine wants slices or wants G-code directly. And we see it going that way.
And you're fighting insane stuff. Robots, for example. Their operating systems are from the last century. It's insane. They have, I don't know, 4 kilobytes of RAM or whatever, and then they overflow when you send them stuff. So, nobody has done a truly digital manufacturing change.
Sure.
It's all parts and pieces.
3D printing is the closest because it's fairly logically to describe, because the starting condition is always nothing. Awesome.
Sure.
Then you have one direction you build up. So it's relatively logical.
It's easier in a way.
Yes, even CNC milling is still black magic, alchemistry.
Sure.
Tribal knowledge.
It's
yeah.
Tribal knowledge.
Everybody does it differently. Oh, yeah.
So we will get there, but 3D printing has an advantage.
But to sum it up, I think it's important to understand that computational engineering is not just for 3D printing. It is a way of describing objects through algorithms that can work with any manufacturing process.
Yeah.
But as you said, 3D printing is the easiest one because it has very few rules. And if you follow these rules, you usually get something.
Sure.
That's a paradigm shift, though, when we're saying 3D printing is the easiest one, right? We're looking at it from the other side.
For us, yes.
And again, what we are trying to achieve is we're trying to look at the end goal. Where do we want to be? What do we want to actually create? And then also choose the right manufacturing methods and the right computational engineering designs, to get there. And one of the things that we're really interested in is building an integrated manufacturing cell for electromagnetic actuators. Because I think all the pieces are there. Nobody has really put it all together. And this is something that we are highly interested in. And motors for robotics, these are two fields that are super interesting and ready for disruption.
So in this whole conversation, you never use the term AI. So when you say algorithm, is it the same? It's the same.
What is AI? 20 years ago, everybody thought an expert system is AI, like an AI doctor.
Right? Like a decision tree.
Yeah. If you have a running nose and your ear hurts, you probably have this disease. You know? So this is how AI used to be, expert systems, hand-coded, if then else. And then as things shifted, now AI means a large language model. Before AI meant vision detection. It's shifting all the time.
Right.
So one of our friends, the minister of AI here in the UAE, says it's always called AI until somebody finds a good name for it. and now a large language model is no longer called AI because it's a large language model. So what we do is software. It's not really AI how you think AI is today. However, there's an interesting aspect to it. Large language models can code, they can write code.
Sure.
And it's a clear path from what we do today, hand-coded algorithms, to maybe a large language model can actually synthesize the algorithm that we're currently writing by hand. Now, how do we get there? We first have to hand code a lot of things by hand,
right,
and then train the AI. Right? That's something we're interested in.
Sure.
And then we're probably not the only ones who are interested in that.
Yeah.
However, there's one distinction that I want to make between us and many of the generative AI, CAD, blah, design companies. There's a lot of people who think if you show enough people an electric motor, if you show a neural net, it makes enough electric motors, it will magically design an electric motor at some point. And we think this is idiotic because, you know, even if I show you a lot of electric motors and you have no clue about how an electric motor works, you're probably not going to design an electric motor.
You could draw one.
Yeah, you
it
could
wouldn't
draw one,
function.
But it wouldn't work. So we think you first have to train large language models and neural nets on functioning code, on examples of how you design this thing in logic, not the visuals. How it looks like is actually not so interesting. And nobody's training these systems how it works. They always train it how it looks like.
Yeah.
Because no one actually writes this code.
So we probably have the biggest library of computational models for functioning machines. And we are a two-person team, and fundamentally we are a one-person team, because Josephine writes these models. And that's silly. Why are we the only ones, right? Hopefully we will see lots of GitHub repository of computational engineering models that people can train large language models on, and that can then create something like jobs.
Future scenario, once we have trained such an AI, I would basically say, oh, could you give me a code snippet for a heat exchanger with three fins inside or whatever? And the AI would actually give me the code, which means that I see what's going on and I can then write into it and change it. So it's more like an interplay. It's not like the AI system will magically confront me with some black box thing and I can't do anything about it. It won't be like that.
If you're interested, I wrote two articles about this in the past. One I wrote almost a year ago about how do we get to Jarvis, the mythical Iron Man assistant. They always say, I want to build a rocket engine. Okay, give me a no, please change this and that. There's one, this what Josephine just described is one way to get there. The other thing I wrote just recently is there's a difference between understanding something and basically what a large language model currently does. A large language model doesn't understand anything about what it's saying. It just has been trained on an enormous amount of data so it can synthesize something that sounds reasonable. And we use it every day. It's amazing. I mean, it has replaced Google for most of the stuff that we do because it can summarize things for you. But you still have to think and put it into your mental model. So if you have computational knowledge, you have a mental model about how things work. And that's what we're building manually. If you have a large language model, you have a way to synthesize things trained on a large data set that is giving you a tremendous amount of insight. So if you combine these tools, you actually get somewhere that's a super, super interesting place. And that's basically where I spend my time these days. Now, how do I connect what Josephine is doing manually to something that can be synthesized automatically. And it's a very interesting thing to do.
You use these methods to write Peacock also?
Yeah.
For the trivial stuff.
That's interesting. I wrote an open source geometry kernel called Peacock in a few weeks. How can I do this? Am I some magic genius? No. First of all, there's a lot of open source software that was developed over the last decade that you can base yourself on. It's a voxel-based geometry kernel that is being used in Visual Effects, so I use that as a basis. But then the other thing is, a lot of the algorithms that we took years to develop in the Hyperganic, you can just ask ChatGPT to write it for you. It's correct. Fantastic. You can even ask it to look at your code and say, this is not working. I made a mistake somewhere. And said, yeah, you switched X and Y in the second loop over there. And it's like, it would take you days to find this because it's, I don't know, 100 lines of code and there's one X and Y or a sign that was flipped or something. You never find it, but you put it into ChatGPT and it helps you. So it's an amazing tool if you use it for what it is designed for. If you combine these tools with the computational approach that we're doing, it will be very interesting. Engineers will work in such a different way in the future. But I want to highlight what Josephine said. It gives you the code that creates something. So you as the engineer, you can still look at the result and say, no, it's not right. I can fix it by changing the code manually. And that's very important. Just like you, when you're probably not using ChatGPT to write your articles because it always looks like a bit off, whatever. But you can use it to summarize something.
Of course.
And you change a few sentences so it actually summarizes.
Right? We use it a lot as a tool. It's a collaboration, really, with the
Gemma. It's a collaboration. Yeah. It's a collaboration. It helps you get started, but it doesn't do the final thing for you.
So, yeah, it will not take off the heavy load of actually using your brain as an engineer.
Yeah. Or as a journalist. That's the point. We know what we want. Yeah. AI doesn't know what it wants. It doesn't want anything. It just gives you something.